misery, incompletion, and incomprehension. They were the eyes of a trapped and terrified animal. I thought of what he'd said about how Wharton had gotten Cora and Kathy Dederick off the porch without rousing the house. He killed them with their love. That's how it is every day, all over the world. Brutal took the new mask from its brass hook on the back of the chair, but as soon as John saw it and understood what it was, his eyes widened in horror. He looked at me, and now I could see huge droplets of sweat standing out on the curve of his naked skull. As big as robin's eggs, they looked.
"Please, boss, don't put that thing over my face," he said in a moaning little whisper. "Please don't put me in the dark. Don't make me go into the dark. I was afraid of the dark."
Brutal was looking at me, eyebrows raised, frozen in place, the mask in his hands. His eyes said it was my call. He'd go either way. I thought as fast as I could, and as well as I could, hard to do with my head pounding the way it was. The mask was tradition, not law. It was, in fact, to spare the witnesses. And suddenly I decided that they did not need to be spared. Not this once. John, after all, hadn't done a damned thing in his life to warrant being where he was. They didn't know that. But we did, and I decided I was going to grant this last request. As for Marjorie Dederick, she'd probably send me a thank you note. "All right, John," I murmured. Brutal put the mask back. From behind us, Homer Kribus called out indignantly in his deep-dish cracker voice,
"Say, boy, put that damn mask on him. Think we want to watch his eyes pop?"
"Be quiet, sir," I said without turning. "This is an execution, and you're not in charge of it."
"Any more than you were in charge of catching him, you tub of guts," Harry whispered.
Harry died in 1982, close to the age of 80, an old man. Not in my league, of course, but few are. It was intestinal cancer of some kind. Brutal bent over and plucked a disc of sponge out of its bucket. He pressed a finger into it and licked the tip, but he hardly had to. I could see the ugly brown thing dripping. He tucked it into the cap, then put the cap on John's head. For the first time, I saw that Brutal was pale, too, pasty white, on the verge of passing out. I thought of him saying that he felt for the first time in his life that he was in danger of hell because we were fixing to kill a gift of God. I felt a sudden and strong need to retch. I controlled it, but only with an effort. Water from the sponge was dripping down the sides of John's face. Dean Stanton ran the strap, let out to its maximum length on this occasion, across John's chest and gave it to me. We had taken such pains to try and protect Dean on the night of our trip because of his kids, never knowing that he had less than 4 months to live. After John Coffey, he requested and received a transfer away from old Sparky over to C-Block, and there a prisoner stabbed him in the throat with a shank and let out his life's blood on a dirty board floor. I never knew why. I don't think anyone ever knew why. Old Sparky seems such a thing of perversity when I look back on those days, such a deadly bit of folly. Fragile as blown glass we are, even under the best of conditions. To kill each other with gas and electricity and in cold blood? The folly. The horror. Brutal checked the strap, then stood back. I waited for him to speak, but he didn't. As he crossed his hands behind his back and stood at parade rest, I knew that he wouldn't, perhaps couldn't. I didn't think I could either. But then I looked at John's terrified, weeping eyes and knew I had to. Even if it damned me forever, I had to.
"Roll on to,"
I said in a dusty, cracking voice I hardly recognized as my own. The cap hummed. 8 large fingers and 2 large thumbs rose from the ends of the chair's broad oak arms and splayed tensely in 10 different directions, their tips jittering. His big knees made caged pistoning motions, but the clamps on his ankles held. Overhead, three of the hanging lights blew out. Pow! 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 Marjorie Dederick screamed at the sound and fainted in her husband's arms. She died in Memphis 18 years later. Harry sent me the obit. It was a trolley car accident. John surged forward against the chest strap. For a moment, his eyes met mine. They were aware. I was the last thing he saw as we tilted him off the edge of the world. Then he fell against the seat back, the cap coming askew on his head, a little smoke, a sort of charry mist drifting out from beneath it. But on the whole, you know, it was quick. I doubt if it was painless, the way the chair's supporters always claim. It's not an idea even the most rabid of them ever seems to want to investigate personally. But it was quick. The hands were limp again. The formerly bluish-white moons at the base of the fingernails, now a deep eggplant hue, a tendril of smoke rising off cheeks still wet with salt water from the sponge, and his tears. John Coffey's last tears. Chapter 11. I was all right until I got home. It was dawn by then, and birds singing. I parked my flivver, I got out, I walked up the back steps, and then the second greatest grief I have ever known washed over me. It was thinking of how he'd been afraid of the dark that did it. I remembered the first time we'd met, how he'd asked if we left a light on at night, and my legs gave out on me. I sat on my steps and hung my head over my knees and cried. It didn't feel like that weeping was just for John, either. But for all of us. Janice came out and sat down beside me. She put an arm over my shoulders. "You didn't hurt him any more than you could help, did you?" I shook my head, no. "And he wanted to go." I nodded. "Come in the house," she said, helping me up. It made me think of the way John had helped me up after we'd prayed together. "Come in and have coffee." I did. The first morning passed, and the first afternoon, then the first shift back at work. Time takes it all, whether you want it to or not. Time takes it all. Time bears it away. And in the end, there is only darkness. Sometimes we find others in that darkness, and sometimes we lose them there again. That's all I know. Except that this happened in 1932, when the state penitentiary was still at Cold Mountain. And the electric chair, of course. Chapter 12. Around 2:15 in the afternoon, my friend Elaine Connolly came to me where I sat in the sunroom with the last pages of my story squared up neatly in front of me. Her face was very pale, and there were shiny places under her eyes. I think she had been crying. Me, I'd been looking. Just that, looking out the window and over the hills to the east, my right hand throbbing at the end of its wrist. But it was a peaceful throb, somehow. I felt empty, husked out, a feeling that was terrible and wonderful at the same time. It was hard to meet Elaine's eyes. I was afraid of the hate and contempt I might see there. But they were all right. Sad and wondering, but all right. No hate, no contempt, and no disbelief. "Do you want the rest of the story?" I asked. I tapped the little pile of script with my aching hand. "It's here, but I'll understand if you'd just as soon not." "It isn't a question of what I want," she said. "I have to know how it came out. Although I guess there is no doubt that you executed him. The intervention of Providence with a capital P is greatly overrated in the lives of ordinary humans, I think. But before I take those pages, Paul..." She stopped as if unsure how to go on. I waited. Sometimes you can't help people. Sometimes it's better not even to try. "Paul," you speak in here as though you had two grown children in 1932. Not just one, but two. If you didn't get married to your Janice when you were 12 and she was 11, something like that, I smiled a little. We were young when we married. A lot of hill people are. My own mother was. But not that young. Then, how old are you? I've always assumed you were in your early 80s, my age, possibly even a little younger, but according to this... I was 40 the year John walked the Green Mile, I said. I was born in 1892. That makes me 104, unless my reckoning's out. She stared at me, speechless. I held out the rest of the manuscript, remembering again how John had touched me there in his cell. You won't explode, he'd said, smiling a bit at the very idea, and I hadn't. But something had happened to me all the same. Something lasting. Read the rest of it, I said. What answers I have are in there. All right, she almost whispered. I'm a little afraid to. I can't lie about that, but... All right. Where will you be? I stood up, stretched, listened to my spine crackle in my back. One thing that I knew for sure was that I was sick to death of the sunroom. Out on the croquet course. There's still something I want to show you, and it's in that direction. Is it scary? In her timid look, I saw the little girl she had been back when men wore straw boaters in the summer and raccoon coats in the winter. No, I said, smiling, not scary. All right, she took the pages. I'm going to take these down to my room. I'll see you out on the croquet course around, she riffled the manuscript, estimating. 4, is that all right? Perfect, I said, thinking of the too curious Brad Dolan. He would be gone by then. She reached out, gave my arm a little squeeze, and left the room. I stood where I was for a moment, looking down at the table, taking in the fact that it was bare again, except for the breakfast tray Elaine had brought me that morning, my scattered papers at last gone. I somehow couldn't believe I was done. And as you can see, since all this was written, after I recorded John Coffey's execution and gave the last batch of pages to Elaine, I was not. And even then, part of me knew why. Alabama. I filched the last piece of cold toast off the tray, went downstairs and out onto the croquet course. There I sat in the sun, watching half a dozen pairs and one slow but cheerful foursome pass by, waving their mallets, thinking my old man's thoughts and letting the sun warm my old man's bones. Around 2:45, the 3-to-11 shift started to trickle in from the parking lot, and at 3, the day shift folks left. Most were in groups, but Brad Dolan, I saw, was walking alone. That was sort of a cheery sight. Maybe the world hasn't gone entirely to hell after all. One of his joke books was sticking out of his back pocket. The path to the parking lot goes by the croquet course, so he saw me there, but he didn't give me either a wave or a scowl. That was fine by me. He got into his old Chevrolet with the bumper sticker reading, "I have seen God, and his name is Newt." Then he was gone to wherever he goes when he isn't here, laying a thin trail of discount motor oil behind. Around 4 o'clock, Elaine joined me just as she had promised. From the look of her eyes, she'd done a little more crying. She put her arms around me and hugged me tight. "Poor John Coffey," she said, "and poor Paul Edgecombe, too." "Poor Paul," I heard Jan saying. "Poor old guy." Elaine began to cry again. I held her there on the croquet course in the late sunshine. Our shadows looked as if they were dancing, perhaps in the make-believe ballroom we used to listen to on the radio back in those days. At last she got herself under control and drew back from me. She found a Kleenex in her dress pocket and wiped her streaming eyes with it. What happened to the warden's wife, Paul? What happened with Melly? She was considered the marvel of the age, at least by the doctors at Indianola Hospital, I said. I took her arm, and we began to walk toward the path which led away from the employees' parking lot and into the woods, toward the shed down by the wall between Georgia Pines and the world of younger people. She died of a heart attack, not a brain tumor, 10 or 11 years later, in 43, I think. Hal died of a stroke right around Pearl Harbor Day. Could have been on Pearl Harbor Day, for all I remember. So she outlived him by 2 years. Sort of ironic. And Janice? I'm not quite prepared for that today, I said. I'll tell you another time. Promise? Promise. But that was one I never kept. 3 months after the day we walked down into the woods together, I would have held her hand if I hadn't been afraid of hurting her bunched and swollen fingers. Elaine Connolly died quietly in her bed. As with Melinda Moore's, death came as the result of a heart attack. The orderly who found her said she looked peaceful, as if it had come suddenly and without much pain. I hope he was right about that. I loved Elaine, and I miss her. Her and Janice and Brutal and just all of them. We reached the second shed on the path, the one down by the wall. It stood back in a bower of scrub pines, its sagging roof and boarded over windows laced and dappled with shadows. I started toward it. Elaine hung back a moment, looking fearful. "It's all right," I said. "Really, come on." There was no latch on the door. There had been once, but it had been torn away, and so I used a folded-over square of cardboard to wedge it shut. I pulled it free now and stepped into the shed. I left the door as wide open as it would go because it was dark inside. "Paul? What? Oh. Oh!" That second O was just shy of a scream. There was a table pushed off to one side. On it was a flashlight and a brown paper bag. On the dirty floor was a Havatempa cigar box I'd gotten from the concession man who refills the home soft drink and candy machines. I'd asked him for it special, and since his company also sells tobacco products, it was easy for him to get. I offered to pay him for it. They were valuable commodities when I worked at Cold Mountain, as I may have told you, but he just laughed me off. Peering over the edge of it were a pair of bright little oil-spot eyes. "Mr. Jingles," I said in a low voice, "come over here. Come on over here, old boy, and see this lady." I squatted down, it hurt, but I managed, and held out my hand. At first I didn't think he was going to be able to get over the side of the box this time, but he made it, with one final lunge. He landed on his side, then regained his feet and came over to me. He ran with a hitching limp in one of his back legs. The injury that Percy had inflicted had come back in Mr. Jingle's old age. His old, old age. Except for the top of his head and the tip of his tail, his fur had gone entirely gray. He hopped onto the palm of my hand. I raised him up, and he stretched his neck out, sniffing at my breath with his ears laid back and his tiny, dark eyes avid. I held my hand out toward Elaine, who looked at the mouse with wide-eyed wonder, her lips parted. "It can't be," she said, and raised her eyes to me. "Oh, Paul, it isn't... It can't be." "Watch," I said, "and then tell me that." From the bag on the table I took a spool which I had colored myself, not with Crayolas but with magic markers, an invention undreamed of in 1932. It came to the same, though. It was as bright as Dell's had been, maybe brighter. "Messieurs et mesdames," I thought, "bienvenue au Cirque du Mousy." I squatted again, and Mr. Jingles ran off my palm. He was old, but as obsessed as ever. From the moment I had taken the spool out of the bag, he'd had eyes for nothing else. I rolled it across the shed's uneven, splintery floor, and he was after it at once. He didn't run with his old speed, and his limp was painful to watch, but why should he have been either fast or sure-footed? As I've said, he was old, a Methuselah of a mouse, 64 at least. He reached the spool, which struck the far wall, and bounced back. He went around it, then lay down on his side. Elaine started forward, and I held her back. After a moment, Mr. Jingles found his feet again. Slowly, so slowly, he nosed the spool back to me. When he'd first come, I'd found him lying on the steps leading to the kitchen in just that same way, as if he'd traveled a long distance and was exhausted, he had still been able to guide the spool with his paws, as he had done all those years ago on the Green Mile. That was beyond him now. His hindquarters would no longer support him. Yet his nose was as educated as ever. He just had to go from one end of the spool to the other to keep it on course. When he reached me, I picked him up in one hand, no more than a feather he weighed, and the spool in the other. His bright, dark eyes never left it.
"Don't do it again, Paul," Elaine said in a broken voice. "I can't bear to watch him."
I understood how she felt, but thought she was wrong to ask it. He loved chasing and fetching the spool. After all the years, he still loved it just as much. We should all be so fortunate in our passions. "There are peppermint candies in the bag, too," I said. "Canada mints. I think he still likes them. He won't stop sniffing if I hold one out to him. But his digestion has gotten too bad to eat them. I bring him toast instead." I squatted again, broke a small fragment off the piece I'd brought with me from the sunroom and put it on the floor. Mr. Jingles sniffed at it, then picked it up in his paws and began to eat. His tail was coiled neatly around him. He finished, then looked expectantly up. "Sometimes us old fellas can surprise you with our appetites," I said to Elaine, and handed her the toast. "You try." She broke off another fragment and dropped it on the floor. Mr. Jingles approached it, sniffed, looked at Elaine, then picked it up and began to eat. "You see," I said, "he knows you're not a floater."
"Where did he come from, Paul?"
"Haven't a clue. One day when I went out for my early morning walk, he was just here, lying on the kitchen steps. I knew who he was right away, but I got a spool out of the laundry room occasional basket just to be sure. And I got him a cigar box, lined it with the softest stuff I could find. He's like us, Ellie, I think. Most days just one big sore place. Still, he hasn't lost all his zest for living. He still likes his spool, and he still likes a visit from his old blockmate. 60 years I held the story of John Coffey inside me. 60 and more. And now I've told it. I kind of had the idea that's why he came back, to let me know I should hurry up and do it while there was still time. Because I'm like him. Getting there."
"Getting where?"
"Oh, you know," I said. And we watched Mr. Jingles for a while in silence. Then, for no reason I could tell you, I tossed the spool again, even though Elaine had asked me not to. Maybe only because, in a way, him chasing the spool was like old people having their slow and careful version of sex. You might not want to watch it, you who are young and convinced that when it comes to old age, an exception will be made in your case. But they still want to do it. Mr. Jingles set off after the rolling spool again, clearly with pain, and just as clearly, to me at least, with all his old obsessive enjoyment.
"Ivy glass windows," she whispered, watching him go.
"Ivy glass windows," I agreed, smiling.
"John Coffey touched the mouse the way he touched you. He didn't just make you better of what was wrong with you then. He made you, what, resistant?"
"That's as good a word as any, I think."
"Resistant to the things that eventually bring the rest of us down like trees with termites in them. You and him, Mr. Jingles, when he cupped Mr. Jingles in his hands."
"That's right. Whatever power worked through John did that, that's what I think anyway. And now it's finally wearing off.
The termites have chewed their way through our bark. It took a little longer than it does ordinarily, but they got there. I may have a few more years. Men still live longer than mice, I guess, but Mr. Jingles' time is just about up. He reached the spool, limped around it, fell over on his side, breathing rapidly. We could see his respiration moving through his gray fur like ripples, then got up and began to push it gamely back with his nose. His fur was gray, his gait was unsteady, but the oil spots that were his eyes gleamed as brightly as ever. "You think he wanted you to write what you have written?" she said. "Is that so, Paul?" "Not Mr. Jingles," I said. "Not him, but the force that..." "Why, Polly! And Elaine Connolly, too!" a voice cried from the open door. It was loaded with a kind of satiric horror. "As I live and breathe, what in the goodness can you two be doing here?" I turned, somehow not at all surprised to see Brad Dolan there in the doorway. He was grinning as a man only does when he feels he's fooled you right good and proper. How far down the road had he driven after his shift was over? Maybe only as far as the Wrangler for a beer or two and maybe a lap dance before coming back. "Get out," Elaine said coldly. "Get out right now." "Don't you tell me to get out, you wrinkledy old bitch," he said, still smiling. "Maybe you can tell me that up the hill, but you ain't up the hill now. This ain't where you're supposed to be. This is off limits. Little love nest, Polly, is that what you got here? Kind of a playboy pad for the geriatric?" His eyes widened as he at last saw the shed's tenant. "What the fuck?" I didn't turn to look. I knew it was there, for one thing. For another, the past had suddenly doubled over the present, making one terrible image, three-dimensional in its reality. It wasn't Brad Dolan standing there in the doorway, but Percy Wetmore. In another moment, he would rush into the shed and crush Mr. Jingles, who no longer had a hope of outrunning him, under his shoe. And this time, there was no John Coffey to bring him back from the edge of death, any more than there had been a John Coffey when I needed him on that rainy day in Alabama. I got to my feet, not feeling any ache in my joints or muscles this time, and rushed toward Dolan. "Leave him alone!" I yelled. "You leave him alone, Percy, or by God, who you calling Percy?" he asked, and pushed me back so hard I almost fell over. Elaine grabbed me, although it must have hurt her to do so, and steadied me.
"Ain't the first time you done it, either. And stop peeing in your pants. I ain't gonna touch him, and no need to. That's one dead rodent."
I turned, thinking that Mr. Jingles was only lying on his side to catch his breath the way he sometimes did. He was on his side all right, but that rippling motion through his fur had stopped. I tried to convince myself that I could still see it. And then Elaine burst into loud sobs. She bent painfully and picked up the mouse I had first seen on the Green Mile, coming up to the duty desk as fearlessly as a man approaching his peers or his friends. He lay limp on her hand. His eyes were dull and still. He was dead. Dolan grinned unpleasantly, revealing teeth which had had very little acquaintance with a dentist.
"Aw, sakes now," he said. "Did we just lose the family pet? Should we have a little funeral with paper flowers and..."
"Shut up!" Elaine screamed at him, so loudly and so powerfully that he backed away a step, the smile slipping off his face. "Get out of here! Get out or you'll never work another day here, not another hour, I swear it!"
"You won't be able to get so much as a slice of bread on a bread line," I said, but so low neither of them heard me.
I couldn't take my eyes off Mr. Jingles, lying on Elaine's palm like the world's smallest bearskin rug. Brad thought about coming back at her, calling her bluff. He was right, the shed wasn't exactly approved territory for the Georgia Pines inmates, even I knew that much. And then didn't. He was at heart a coward, just like Percy. And he might have checked on her claim that her grandson was somebody important and had discovered it was a true claim. Most of all, perhaps, his curiosity had been satisfied, his thirst to know slaked.
And after all his wondering, the mystery had turned out not to be such of a much. An old man's pet mouse had apparently been living in the shed. Now it had croaked, had a heart attack or something while pushing a colored spool.
"Don't know why you're getting so het up," he said. "Either of you. You act like it was a dog or something."
"Get out," she spat. "Get out, you ignorant man. What little mind you have is ugly and misdirected."
He flushed dully, the spots where his high school pimples had been filling in a darker red. There had been a lot of them, by the look.
"I'll go," he said. "But when you come down here tomorrow, Polly, you're going to find a new lock on this door. This place is off-limits to the residents, no matter what bad-tempered things old Mrs. My Shit Don't Stink has to say about me. Look at the floor. Boards all warped and rotted. If you was to go through, your scrawny old leg would be apt to snap like a piece of kindling. So just take that dead mouse if you want it and get gone. The love shack is hereby closed."
He turned and strode away, looking like a man who believes he's earned at least a draw. I waited until he was gone, and then gently took Mr. Jingles from Elaine. My eyes happened on the bag with the peppermint candies in it, and that did it. The tears began to come. I don't know, I just cry easier somehow these days. "Would you help me to bury an old friend?" I asked Elaine when Brad Dolan's heavy footsteps had faded away.
"Yes, Paul."
She put her arm around my waist and laid her head against my shoulder. With one old and twisted finger, she stroked Mr. Jingle's moveless side.
"I would be happy to do that."
And so we borrowed a trowel from the gardening shed, and we buried Dell's pet mouse as the afternoon shadows drew long through the trees. And then we walked back to get our supper and take up what remains of our lives. And it was Dell I found myself thinking of. Dell kneeling on the green carpet of my office with his hands folded and his bald pate gleaming in the lamplight. Dell who had asked us to take care of Mr. Jingles, to make sure the bad'un wouldn't hurt him any more. Except the bad'un hurts us all in the end, doesn't he?
"Paul?"
Elaine asked. Her voice was both kind and exhausted. Even digging a grave with a trowel and laying a mouse to rest in it is a lot of excitement for old sweeties like us, I guess.
"Are you all right?"
My arm was around her waist. I squeezed it. "I'm fine," I said.
"Look," she said. "It's going to be a beautiful sunset. Shall we stay out and watch it?"
"All right," I said. And we stayed there on the lawn for quite a while, arms around each other's waists, first watching the bright colors come up in the sky, then watching them fade to ashes of gray.
"Sainte Marie, Mère de Dieu, priez pour nous, pauvres pécheurs, maintenant et à l'heure de notre mort. Amen."
Chapter 13, 1956, Alabama in the rain. Our third grandchild, a beautiful girl named Tessa, was graduating from the University of Florida. We went down on a Greyhound. 64 I was then, a mere stripling. Jan was 59 and as beautiful as ever, to me at least. We were sitting in the seat all the way at the back, and she was fussing at me for not buying her a new camera to record the blessed event. I opened my mouth to tell her we had a day to shop in after we got down there, and she could have a new camera if she wanted one. It would fit the budget, all right, and furthermore, I thought she was just fussing because she was bored with the ride and didn't like the book she'd brought. A Perry Mason, it was. That's when everything in my memory goes white for a bit. Like film that's been left out in the sun. Do you remember that accident? I suppose a few folks reading this might, but mostly not. Yet it made front page headlines from coast to coast when it happened. We were outside Birmingham in a driving rain, Janice complaining about her old camera, and a tire blew. The bus waltzed sideways on the wet pavement and was hit broadside by a truck hauling fertilizer. The truck slammed the bus into a bridge abutment at better than 60 miles an hour, crushed it against the concrete, and broke it in half. Two shiny, rain-streaked pieces spun in two opposite directions, the one with the diesel tank in it exploding and sending a red-black fireball up into the rainy gray sky. At one moment, Janice was complaining about her old Kodak, and at the very next, I found myself lying on the far side of the underpass in the rain and staring at a pair of blue nylon panties that had spilled out of someone's suitcase. Wednesday was stitched on them in black thread. There were burst-open suitcases everywhere, and bodies, and parts of bodies. There were 73 people on that bus, and only 4 survived the crash. I was one of them, the only one not seriously hurt. I got up and staggered among the burst-open suitcases and shattered people, crying out my wife's name. I kicked aside an alarm clock, I remember that, and I remember seeing a dead boy of about 13 lying in a strew of glass with PF flyers on his feet and half his face gone. I felt the rain beating on my own face, then I went through the underpass, and it was gone for a while. When I came out on the other side, it was there again, hammering my cheeks and forehead. Lying by the cab of the overturned fertilizer truck, I saw Jan. I recognized her by her red dress. It was her second best. The best she had been saving for the actual graduation, of course. She wasn't quite dead. I have often thought it would have been better for me, if not for her, if she had been killed instantly. It might have made it possible for me to let her go a little sooner, a little more naturally. Well, perhaps I'm only kidding myself about that. All I know for sure is that I have never let her go. Not really. She was trembling all over. One of her shoes had come off, and I could see her foot jittering. Her eyes were open, but blank, the left one full of blood. And as I fell on my knees next to her in the smoky-smelling rain, all I could think of was that jitter meant she was being electrocuted. She was being electrocuted, and I had to hold the roll before it was too late. "Help me!" I screamed. "Help me! Someone help me!" No one helped. No one even came. The rain pounded down, a hard, soaking rain that flattened my still black hair against my skull, and I held her in my arms and no one came. Her blank eyes looked up at me with a kind of dazed intensity, and blood poured from the back of her crushed head in a freshet. Beside one trembling, mindlessly spasming hand was a piece of chromed steel with the letters Gray on it. Next to that was roughly one quarter of what had once been a businessman in a brown wool suit.
"Help me!"
I screamed again and turned toward the underpass, and there I saw John Coffey standing in the shadows, only a shadow himself, a big man with long, dangling arms and a bald head.
"John!" I screamed. "Oh, John, please help me! Please help Janice!"
Rain ran into my eyes. I blinked it away, and he was gone. I could see the shadows I had mistaken for John, but it hadn't been only shadows. I'm sure of that. He was there. Maybe only as a ghost, but he was there, the rain on his face mixing with the endless flow of his tears. She died in my arms. There in the rain beside that fertilizer truck with the smell of burning diesel fuel in my nose. There was no moment of awareness, the eyes clearing, the lips moving, and some whispered final declaration of love. There was a kind of shivery clench in the flesh beneath my hands, and then she was gone. I thought of Melinda Moore's for the first time in years then. Melinda sitting up in the bed where all the doctors at Indianola General Hospital had believed she would die. Melinda Moore's looking fresh and rested and peering at John Coffey with bright, wondering eyes. Melinda saying, "I dreamed you were wandering in the dark, and so was I. We found each other." I put my wife's poor, mangled head down on the wet pavement of the interstate highway, got to my feet, it was easy, I had a little cut on the side of my left hand, but that was all, and screamed his name into the shadows of the underpass.
"John! John Coffey! Where are you, big boy?"
I walked toward those shadows, kicking aside a teddy bear with blood on its fur, a pair of steel-rimmed eyeglasses with one shattered lens, a severed hand with a garnet ring on the pinky finger.
"You saved Hal's wife? Why not my wife? Why not Janice? Why not my Janice?"
No answer. Only the smell of burning diesel and burning bodies. Only the rain falling ceaselessly out of the gray sky and drumming on the cement while my wife lay dead on the road behind me. No answer then, and no answer now. But, of course, it wasn't only Mellie Moore's that John Coffey saved in 1932. Or Dell's mouse, the one that could do that cute trick with the spool and seemed to be looking for Dell long before Dell showed up, long before John Coffey showed up either. John saved me, too. And years later, standing in the pouring Alabama rain and looking for a man who wasn't there in the shadows of an underpass, standing amid the spilled luggage and the ruined dead, I learned a terrible thing. Sometimes there is absolutely no difference at all between salvation and damnation. I felt one or the other pouring through me as we sat together on his bunk, November the 18th, 1932. Pouring out of him and into me, whatever strange force he had in him, coming through our joined hands in a way our love and hope and good intentions somehow never can, a feeling that began as a tingle and then turned into something tidal. An enormous, a force beyond anything I had ever experienced before or have ever experienced since. Since that day, I have never had pneumonia, or the flu, or even a strep throat. I have never had another urinary infection, or so much as an infected cut. I have had colds, but they have been infrequent, 6 or 7 years apart, and although people who don't have colds often are supposed to suffer more serious ones, that has never been the case with me. Once, earlier on in that awful year of 1956, I passed a gallstone. And although I suppose it will sound strange to some reading this, in spite of all I have said, part of me relished the pain that came when that gallstone went. It was the only serious pain I'd had since that problem with my waterworks 24 years before. The ills that have taken my friends and same generation loved ones until there are none of them left, the strokes, the cancers, the heart attacks, the liver diseases, the blood diseases, have all left me untouched, have swerved to avoid me, the way a man driving a car swerves to avoid a deer or a raccoon in the road. The one serious accident I was in left me untouched, save for a scratch on the hand. In 1932, John Coffey inoculated me with life. Electrocuted me with life, you might say. I will pass on eventually. Of course I will. Any illusions of immortality I might have had died with Mr. Jingles. But I will have wished for death long before death finds me. Truth to tell, I wish for it already, and have ever since Elaine Connolly died. Need I tell you? I look back over these pages, leafing through them with my trembling, spotted hands, and I wonder if there is some meaning here, as in those books which are supposed to be uplifting and ennobling. I think back to the sermons of my childhood, booming affirmations in the Church of Praise Jesus, the Lord is Mighty, and I recall how the preachers used to say that God's eye is on the sparrow, that he sees and marks even the least of his creations. When I think of Mr. Jingles and the tiny scraps of wood we found in that hole in the beam, I think that is so. Yet this same God sacrificed John Coffey, who tried only to do good in his blind way, as savagely as any Old Testament prophet ever sacrificed a defenseless lamb, as Abraham would have sacrificed his own son if actually called upon to do so. I think of John saying that Wharton killed the Dederick twins with their love for each other, and that it happens every day all over the world. If it happens, God lets it happen, and when we say, I don't understand, God replies, I don't care. I think of Mr. Jingles dying while my back was turned and my attention usurped by an unkind man whose finest emotion seemed to be a species of vindictive curiosity. I think of Janice jittering away her last mindless seconds as I knelt with her in the rain. Stop it, I tried to tell John that day in his cell. Let go of my hands. I'm going to drown if you don't. Drown or explode. You won't explode, he answered, hearing my thought and smiling at the idea. And the horrible thing is that I didn't. I haven't. I have at least one old man's ill. I suffer from insomnia. Late at night, I lie in my bed, listening to the dank and hopeless sound of infirm men and women coughing their courses deeper into old age. Sometimes I hear a call bell, or the squeak of a shoe in the corridor, or Mrs. Javits's little TV turned to the late news. I lie here, and if the moon is in my window, I watch it. I lie here and think about Brutal and Dean and sometimes William Wharton saying, that's right, nigger, bad as you'd want. I think of Delacroix saying, watch this, Boss Edgecombe. I teach Mr. Jingles a new trick. I think of Elaine standing in the door of the sunroom and telling Brad Dolan to leave me alone. Sometimes I doze and see that underpass in the rain with John Coffey standing beneath it in the shadows. It's never just a trick of the eye in these little dreams. It's always him, for sure, my big boy, just standing there and watching. I lie here and wait. I think about Janice, how I lost her, how she ran away red through my fingers in the rain. And I wait. We each owe a death. There are no exceptions. I know that. But sometimes, oh God, the Green Mile is so long. Author's Afterword. I don't know how that was for you, but for me it was a lot of fun. I don't think I'd want to do it again, if only because the critics get to kick your ass 6 times instead of just the once, but I wouldn't have missed the experience for the world. As I write this afterword on the day before Part 2 of The Green Mile is to be published, the serialization experiment is looking like a success, at least in terms of sales. For that, constant reader, I want to thank you. And something a bit different wakes us all up a little, maybe, lets us see the old business of storytelling in a new way. That's how it worked for me, anyway. I wrote in a hurry because the format demanded that I write in a hurry. That was part of the exhilaration, but it also may have produced a number of anachronisms. The guards and prisoners listened to Allen's Alley on their Block E radio, and I doubt if Fred Allen was actually broadcasting in 1932. The same may hold true for Kay Kaiser and his College of Musical Knowledge. This isn't to let me off the hook, but it sometimes seems to me that history which has recently fallen over the horizon is harder to research than the Middle Ages or the time of the Crusades. I was able to determine that Brutal might indeed have called the Mouse on the Mile Steamboat Willie. The Disney cartoon had been in existence almost 4 years by then. But I have a sneaking suspicion that the little pornographic comic book featuring Popeye and Olive Oil is an artifact out of time. I might clean up some of this stuff when and if I decide to do The Green Mile as a single volume, but maybe I'll leave the goofs. After all, doesn't the great Shakespeare himself endow Julius Caesar with the anachronism of a striking clock long before mechanical clocks were invented? Doing The Green Mile as a single volume would present its own unique challenges, I have come to realize. The book certainly couldn't be published as it was issued in its installments. Because I took Charles Dickens as my model, I asked around about how Dickens had handled the problem of refreshing his readers' recollections at the beginning of each new episode. I had expected something like the synopses which preceded each installment of my beloved Saturday Evening Post serials, and discovered that Dickens had not been so crude. He built the synopsis into the actual story. While I was trying to decide how to do this, my wife began telling me, she doesn't exactly nag, but sometimes she advocates rather tirelessly, that I had never really finished the story of Mr. Jingles, the circus mouse. I thought she was right, and began to see that by making Mr. Jingles a secret of Paul Edgecombe's in his old age, I could create a fairly interesting front story. The result is a little bit like the form taken by the film version of Fried Green Tomatoes. In fact, everything in Paul's front story, the story of his life at the Georgia Pines old folks' home, turned out to my satisfaction. I particularly liked the way that Dolan, the orderly, and Percy Wetmore became entwined in Paul's mind. And that was not something I did on purpose. Like the happiest of fictions, it just ambled along and stepped into its place. I want to thank Ralph Vichenanza for bringing me the serial thriller idea in the first place, and all my friends at Viking, Penguin, and Signet for getting behind it, even though they were scared to death at the beginning. All writers are crazy, and of course they knew that. I also want to thank Marcia DeFilippo, who typed a whole stenographer's notebook full of my cramped handwriting and never complained. Well, rarely complained. Most of all, though, I want to thank my wife, Tabitha, who read this story and said she liked it. Writers almost always write with some ideal reader in mind, I think, and my wife is mine. We don't always see eye to eye when it comes to what we each write. Hell, we rarely see eye to eye when we're shopping together in the supermarket. But when she says it's good, it usually is, because she's tough. And if I try to cheat or cut a corner, she always sees it. And you, constant reader, thank you as well. And if you have any ideas about The Green Mile as a single volume, please let me know. Stephen King, April 28, 1996, New York City.
The Green Mile by Stephen King. Read by Frank Muller. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.